Speak up. Up. Speak, speak up. Speak up. Speak up. 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 Speak, speak up. Up. Speak up. Speak up.
Speak up.
Speak up.
Speak, speak up. Up. You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. This is Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM, and this is your host for the hour, Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist here at CJSF. Before we get started on with today's episode, I just want to acknowledge that this program, as well as all of our programs, are broadcasted on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hulkumalum and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here on these lands since time immemorial. And I want to thank you all so much for tuning in on this fine Tuesday morning. This episode is going to be essentially one long interview. And this is because recently I spoke with the Vancouver Public Library's most recent Indigenous Storyteller in Residence, a program that was developed back in 2008 as a way of the Vancouver Public Library to highlight the importance of storytelling as a way to learn about and from Indigenous communities throughout Vancouver. And the newest Indigenous Storyteller in Residence for 2026 is C. Peel. He is a Nishka actor, director, writer, dancer, and producer who has done a lot of work throughout not just Vancouver, but BC in general. He's the Indigenous Outreach Coordinator at The Culch, as well as the Artistic Associate at the Carmen Arts Group in Northern BC. We sat down for a conversation with him, and it went a lot of different places, but in essence, what C. Peel, in his own words, is trying to achieve through this residency is to sort of destabilize the notion that people understand what Indigenous or indigeneity means to them. So without further ado, here is our interview with none other than C. Peel, the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence at the Vancouver Public Library.
My name is C. I'm from the Nishka First Nation on both sides of my family. We trace our geographical roots back to Northwest BC in the Ness Valley. I spend most of my time and my career working in theater in a wide variety of capacities. I had gotten training at Studio 58 at Langara College here in Vancouver as an actor. And I also received the opportunity to build and develop myself in writing, directing. And since finishing my time at Studio in 2020, I've been pursuing a career and been fortunate to work in an even wider variety of capacities. So I've worked as an actor, director, writer, sometimes as a producer. Sometimes I've done a bit of dramaturgical work for some of my friends and colleagues. I've done a little bit of work in dance, though not too much work in dance. And then like the littlest, tiniest bit of like film and TV here and there, mostly just for friends. And I am very excited because my career has now taken me to this residency at the Vancouver Public Library as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence, which one of the things that I really appreciate about the position is that it's really broad-ranging in what it is open to encompassing under that terminology of storyteller, because that's something that I personally carry with my own practice as something that I self-identify as, is as a storyteller. Because what I've come to realize is that for me, I really view the different layers of my career as being supplementary to each other. They feed off of each other, all of these different capacities. The work that I've done as an actor directly informs my work as a director and how I approach directing, and that directly informs my work as a writer, and in the reverse as well. And each of these contributes to the development of my overall understanding of the medium of theater, but theater itself is ultimately just a medium to telling stories, and stories themselves are just a medium to set the stage for the potential to connect between people. And so while theater is the form that I've done well in, enough that I've gotten a career, and while theater is something that I am really passionate about, I think storytelling is ultimately closer to the core of what I do. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And has that always been something that's a part of your life, just wanting to tell stories, wanting to express yourself creatively in that kind of way?
Yeah, I think so. It's been something that... So I was very fortunate that I grew up surrounded by a lot of my traditional culture. Quite a number of my family, while I was growing up, were fluent in Nishka, in our language. And quite a lot of my family and quite a lot of the community is really passionate about some of our traditional art forms and our traditional performing arts forms, community dance practices and celebrations. So I'd grown up around it, and I had an immense passion for our traditional songs and drumming and dancing, to the point where I don't even remember the earliest points at which I was really in love with it. It's actually stories from my older siblings and my parents and my grandparents, aunts and uncles, who would describe that if somebody would be singing one of our songs, like in a bedroom, it'd close the door so that, you know, to disturb the rest of the house. But I would inevitably crawl up to the door and sort of, it was before I could walk, but I could sort of stand up against the door and start banging as though I was trying to drum along with the person in the room. So it's been something, and I've maintained that love for our culture and for performance in general, especially our cultural performances. But it has most definitely been something that seems to have been with me at least farther back than I can remember. So very likely my entire life.
Yeah, and what, when you first saw this opportunity arise, what made you think to yourself, like, oh, this is something I should pursue? This is something that will, that I can really do something with.
Well, the first time I saw it was like, oh, geez, what was that? That was like 4 or 5 years ago, I think. And I was just out of theater school. And one of the interesting things about pursuing this path as a career is that I can't really be too choosy, especially in the first, as an emerging artist, it's really difficult to have a high degree of agency in what type of work a person can land. And so I think it would be more accurate to say that when I found it, I was just eager to find any work. And so I thought, oh, this seems like an interesting position. I had felt maybe I'm not so qualified at that time, because I had been working for maybe a year, and a lot of the people who had landed the residency have quite the resume or quite the amount of community work or, you know, a number of other things that would indicate their expertise in their particular field of storytelling. But I applied anyway because I was like, I just need work. And I think that, I mean, another part of that too is also something that I often say about my viewpoint on being a professional, which is that for certain, for me, it's really not about the money, but it's also not about the money, because unfortunately we all live in this world where rent has to be paid and bills have to be paid and money has to be involved with everything that we do. So I can't not think about the money. And so that also feeds into, not only is this a position where I might be able to pursue developing creative projects, but I also could be paid to do so, which is also a very nice thing to be fortunate to have. But I applied for it 2021 or something like that. Did not make it in that time, which is fine. The rejections are very common in my line of work. But what made me think that that it would be really compelling this time around is that in the time since, I've really been able to foster a curiosity towards the intersection between my professional practice as an artist and my ability to contribute to the communities that I'm a part of and to consider the potential for having an impact at that intersection point. And I think that that's something that lends itself really well to this specific position, because there's this balancing between community programming through VPL, free programming. So that's probably the main thing that I'm doing there. But a percentage of my time is also allowed to be, I'm allowed to focus on a personal project while I'm also at VPL. So it's not completely like I'm just doing something for VPL. There's a little bit of opportunity for me to pursue something outside of all of that, and so I'm really excited to be spending some of the time researching a personal project but my big curiosity is on this meeting place between community and the professional practice, because I feel like it's really easy as a professional to get a little bit too caught up in the fact that there's a business component to all of this, with like ticket sales and publicity and all of this other stuff that is not unimportant, because I think it's very important that people get paid. But I'm very, very curious about what it means for a professional artist to be really intentionally engaging with the community. And I think that's what's at the heart of why I was interested in returning to apply to the position this handful of years later, and why I'm excited to be taking on the responsibility now.
Yeah, I noticed that on the VPL website describing some of the things you're going to be doing, there was like a list of community events that are going to be hosted. And I'm wondering if you had any hand in like the curation of those events.
Yeah, so there's a specific variety of events that are sort of tied to my residency. I think like almost all of them will have some sort of picture with my face on it, unfortunately. But those ones are most certainly things that I had played a hand in sort of developing. One of the things that the residency started off with maybe a month and a half ago now, was like about a 2-week planning period before everything sort of more or less got underway. And that time, as well as some of the time since in March, we've really been sort of trying to plot out first the broad strokes of what are some of the coolest ideas, just generally speaking, that would be fun to pursue, and then what are some of the details that we need to sort out, that type of thing. But the short answer is yes, I played a hand in curating a lot of this programming. I was given a lot of freedom to consider, as well as a lot of support in the sort of open-ended question of, well, what do we want to do? And it was also a part of the application process. I should also mention that a part of the application was submitting a sample of potential events that I might consider programming with VPL, so that they can get a sense as they're selecting applicants for interviews, like, okay, here's a sense of what they're thinking and whether or not it might be a good fit.
To get, I guess, more specific on that, I noticed one of the events is titled Pretendianism, and I was curious as to why specifically that was something that you wanted to focus on or tackle, I guess, throughout this residency.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Pretendianism is really, 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 really tricky, because it is, one, it's an absurd social phenomenon. It manifests itself with some intricate details on a case-by-case basis, but there are also a number of recurring components to when people portray themselves as Indigenous when they're not. And I think that it feels fascinating, but unfortunately, I'm also really, really aware that it's incredibly consequential, not only to the way that institutions operate, but also to the communities from which the people had made themselves responsible towards in their insisted proximity as Pretendians. I think it's something that really, I think it needs to have an incredible amount of nuance in approaching even just the understanding of, because it, the Indigenous identity is something that is extraordinarily complex in itself, which does not make it easier to navigate the Pretendian phenomena, because one of the things that I think is important to be aware of is that there are many Indigenous people who are at different stages of their journey in their connectedness to their culture, to the communities that they might find themselves tied to or anchored towards, and that these are the types of details that are the lived realities of Indigenous people, and that those can also coincidentally set the stage for other people to utilize details in that same fashion as though it was theirs. So an example of a Pretendian might be somebody who is claiming that they've got Indigenous ancestry, but it's very, like, they're only just beginning to reconnect to their roots, or some other family complication, like we kind of knew that a grandparent or a parent had once told us way long ago that they were actually Indigenous, but they kept it on the down low. These things are not untrue for some people, but it's that other people are taking it to be their truth that is only one, it's only one tiny, tiny component of the overall picture of Pretendianism. I think that it's really, really important because we've seen a shift in recent years towards the mainstream being more considerate and interested in the truth and reconciliation conversation. And as a result of that, it's also been fortunate that on the broad level, the amount of opportunities have continued to open up for Indigenous people to take space and to make moves on the, in the arts and culture sector in particular. And these are the same opportunities and positions that we've been seeing, not just recently, but certainly recently, where we've been seeing Pretendianism be uncovered, where people are taking up opportunities that they wouldn't otherwise have, because truthfully they're not Indigenous, or at the very least there are substantiated allegations that a person is not Indigenous in some of the situations. And so I think it's really, really important at this time, if we're going to continue seeing this trend continue, where organizations and institutions are taking a more active approach to their engagement with Indigenous peoples and Indigenous communities, Indigenous artists and culture workers and social workers, that it's really necessary to unpack and observe, even not even necessarily come to a full understanding, but even just observe the nuances that go into such a complicated phenomena as somebody pretending to be an Indigenous person. And I think, fortunately or unfortunately, it's not something that, like, I feel like I can not do anything about, especially because I'm so aware of the phenomena and that I'm also taking up opportunities as well as an Indigenous person and as somebody who can directly trace my lineage and my community connections back to the community of Terrace and to my family in the Nass Valley. And I can trace my lineage far back pre-colonialism, that I think it's such a tricky thing, because It's already tricky enough to land opportunities as an Indigenous person, and it's tricky to find opportunities that allow for the dignified self-agency to determine what exactly the position can mean. It's tricky to find opportunities like that, meaning that a lot of opportunities will sort of have an often subconscious assumption of what indigeneity is, and that can sort of set the stage for a potential limiting on what the true possibilities are for Indigenous people to create art and to self-express, because there's this potential for the understanding to impair who gets selected, because you don't necessarily fit the understanding of what indigeneity is as opposed to what it can be. And even in situations where that's not necessarily the case, it's not as though every company and every institution is chomping at the bit for all of these opportunities. It's tricky enough finding work as an Indigenous person. And then we have to deal with this situation where there are people who are taking up space and opportunities and money and resources and social responsibilities who, it turns out, aren't even genuinely Indigenous. And as an Indigenous artist, it's like I can't not do anything about it. But it's really tricky because that's also something that can set the stage for people to potentially benefit off of it in ways that don't feed back to me. But what I am grateful for is the times where I get the chance to take up a residency and be like, hey, I'd love to center this issue and be paid to do it. So it's like, okay, when the opportunity arises, I think it's a really valuable thing to not even come to like, okay, this is bad or this is good, though that's a component of it, the moral component, but even just to sit with the question, and for me as an artist to be able to present a question both within side of a major institution, a well-funded city institution like Vancouver Public Library, with a good position towards the broader public, to be able to present a question like, what is pretendianism? What does this mean? What does indigeneity itself mean to all of us? What is our understanding of the word going into the conversation before we even start the conversation around indigeneity, pretendianism, opportunity? All of these big, enormous conversations, before we even get there, can we just sit with the curiosity towards what our current understanding is? Because to not do so sets the stage for the continuing reoccurrence of the phenomena. Not that it's going to stop the phenomena, but if we can carry an open-ended curiosity around why does this thing keep happening? I mean, we've got clear reasons, like I mentioned, it's the opportunity, it's the money, it's the acclaim, all of these benefits that can go along with landing a position in a prestigious organization, like not specifically that this has happened, but like a position like what you might find as the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence at the Vancouver Public Library, where it's well-funded, got access to the public, it's got access to all of this other stuff. I feel like it's so vitally important to not leave anything unsaid when it comes to these conversations, because it's not enough to just have a position available. It's also important in the conversation of decolonialism and re-indigenization and cultural evolution to be willing to sit with the discomfort that can come from a potential misstep in, oh, this institution hired somebody and it turns out they're not Indigenous. I think that a part of the journey needs to be, well, no, let's just unpack that. Let's talk this through. And before we even get to the point where it actually occurs, before we even get to that point, can we just sit down and talk about what this actually is? Because, yeah, that's the end of my thoughts. I feel like I'm repeating myself, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, it's an important thing to discuss because you've been given this platform to discuss it. And it's something that, especially like recently, has had such like a magnitude of effect, not just on like the opportunities and resources allotted to Indigenous artists and Indigenous people just generally, but also like a changing of perception of like what is indigeneity as mm-hmm. well. And I noticed in like a Q&A thing you did for this position, you mentioned like, yeah, part of what you're trying to do here is like get people to really think about what that what the term indigenous even means to them.
Mm-hmm. And more accurately, yes. And I think it's so important to also be in a journey and in a process with our relationship to our knowledge that we carry, not necessarily the truth, but to the knowledge that we carry, what we think, how we feel, how we know something. That how component is so vital in this conversation, because it's not just enough to understand what we understand, but it's also important to sit with the question of how did we come to understand what we think we understand, whether or not it's true, as it might well be the truth. But this idea of what does indigenous mean to any one of us, equally important is how exactly did any one of us get to a point of understanding indigeneity the way that we did, that we're seeing social phenomena like pretendianism, another iteration of negatively consequential social phenomena is residential school denialism. So for a person who is a residential school denialist, somebody who at the least is downplaying the potential significance, like somebody who's saying, well, was it really that bad? Or whatever it is that they end up saying, to outright denying and saying, well, no, it wasn't, whatever it is. A residential school denialist has an understanding of the word indigenous, of indigenous people, of First Nations people, of indigenous history and current events and the relationship to the church and to the federal and provincial governments, all of this stuff. They have an understanding of it. It's important to be able to identify and find the shape of that understanding, to be able to know it, to make changes so that that doesn't happen as often. But it's also important, in my view, to also try and unpack how did a person get to that understanding that it would then manifest as residential school denialism, that it would then manifest as pretendianism. What set the stage for them to understand that in the first place, so that then if we're looking to make social change, if I'm looking to make social change, I can also be able to identify those things in the future, or even further, set the stage for that type of a relationship to the knowledge to be less likely to occur. So it's this question not just of, okay, what do we know? What is our understanding? But how did we get here? How did we even get to the place that we're at before we're even considering how we might get to where we're going in the future? It's this, how do we relate to the knowledge that we have, that I think is also really important. And that's a big part of why I think pretendianism is something that's so important to unpack, because pretendianism has a long-standing history of recurring time and time again. It's almost deeply intrinsic to the film and television art form, not in the least because of the use of red face in the earliest stages before anyone was even considering it a possibility to hire indigenous people. It was just white people in red face, especially because it was all black and white, so you just had to get the grayscale tone right. At its foundation, a lot of modern day media has a legacy of people not being indigenous but representing themselves as indigenous. Now, it can be argued in some instances that there was a knowingness for some people who were just in red face that, oh, well, everybody was in on it, so it's like, okay, whatever. Not whatever as in we don't need to care about it, but whatever as in it's not exactly necessarily the same thing as somebody saying on a stage to the public, I'm indigenous. But we also have examples like, I think his name was Iron Eyes Cody, an early black and white film star who did a lot of cowboys and Indians movies and identified himself as indigenous, said I'm American Indian. And he went through his entire life believing that, died believing that. Most of the public believed that. After he had passed away, it was uncovered that he wasn't actually American Indian at all. He was an Italian immigrant who fell in love with Americans and Indians through movies that he had seen in Italy, moved to America, and put it all on and lived a life as though that was him. It's something that we can trace back in contemporary culture through the earliest stages of film and TV. And why this is important is because this is just one tiny little sliver of an example of something that can potentially set the stage for somebody to have an understanding of indigeneity that is not necessarily correct. And it's also not limited to historical points either. This is also why pretendianism is important, because somebody's understanding of indigeneity might have been deeply rooted, and the foundations of which might have been set in their appreciation of Buffy St. Marie, as an example. Mm-hmm. And we can sort of unpack the specific details of those allegations and about the impact of that of this person being accused of being a pretendian. But if a person is not indigenous, but they're saying that they are, and they're portraying indigeneity as though their version was authentic, but it ultimately isn't, and we discover that, is somebody else who is influenced by that representation, believing it to be genuine, is their understanding of indigeneity still genuine? Like, what are the implications for somebody else being impacted by the representation and the misrepresentation through the willful concealing of the ultimate truth? What does that do to our understanding of indigeneity? Where do we get our understandings of this in the first place? A big component of that is the people who are taking up public-facing opportunities. So all of these, it's like this really interconnected picture that sort of continually feeds back into itself. Indigeneity ties into the pretendian phenomenon, just as the pretendian phenomenon ties back into a broader understanding of indigenous as a social identifier and an identity marker, and something that a person can take as truthful identity, as it is, I'm indigenous, but it's something that the word is so vast, in part because of all of this. And so it's all really an interrelated web of information that I think is so necessary to sit with, and also to carry an awareness of how it interrelates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I guess I wanted to ask, like, you mentioned a project being a part of this residency, and mm-hmm. I'm wondering if everything we've been talking about so far, if that's in your mind, if those are things that you want to implement into whatever this project ends up being.
Yeah, absolutely. So the personal project that I pitched to do is both a new project and kind of a continuation, because I've been sitting with all of these themes for a long time about the impact of representation and misrepresentation and the ways that we come to understand indigenous as a word, not even necessarily indigeneity, not necessarily indigenous social events and just indigenous, the word. So a question that I've been sitting with that is at the heart of my personal project here at VPL, as well as it had been at the heart of a different project. So I'm looking to figure out how does the question manifest in a different form. But the question is, what comes to your mind when I say the word indigenous? And how did that get there? How did that understanding get there in the first place? What set the stage for that understanding? The first iteration of the project was a dance theater piece that I developed in a residency with Raven Spirit Dance. They are an indigenous dance company here in Vancouver. I spent about a year in a developmental residency where I worked alongside a mentor to work on a personal project. And that was 2024. I worked with Yvette Nolan, an Indigenous artist, fantastic, outstanding artist, really, really insightful. And in one of our conversations about the project and about the nature of it, she had said something that ended up becoming the title of that version of the piece, which was that a lot of the things that I'm sort of sitting with and unpacking with as an Indigenous person, these are the things that I cannot unknow. And so that became the title, The Things I Cannot Unknow. That original version of the project, it came about because at the start of the residency, I had a general idea of these themes, but not necessarily like, okay, what exactly do I want to do with it as like a show or a dance piece? It wasn't clear what it would be, but what was underneath it was clear-ish. So I sent a handful of random materials that I was sort of reading into, looking at, and inspired by, as well as a few like tiny bits of things that I wrote myself in just like this Word document. I sent stuff to Yvette as the beginnings of like, here's what I'm sitting with. I'm not sure where it goes. This is what we can talk about as an example. One of the ones that really captivated our attention in that first conversation was, I can't remember how I came across it, but there was like this 1600s diary entry, travel journal entry from a European explorer and his first contact with indigenous people on Turtle Island. And it's in some like British Museum archives that are freely available online. But it was really interesting because there were like a few spread out entries of like describing their initial voyage outwards and what they're intending to do, and then describing how they came across like a village of indigenous peoples. And then it described like small moments of trying to understand and communicate with each other. And it described some of the food options that were available and the lifestyle bits and pieces. But it was so fascinating because it was really interesting to see such an really, really old written account from a person and what their perspective happened to be. And then this idea of, well, it seems really interesting to have that alongside a real indigenous person on stage, that there's an inherent tension between these two things that inspires ideas inherently. And from there, I was working with this idea of, okay, so this diary probably set the stage for somebody to have an understanding of indigenous peoples in some fashion. And then that sets the stage for a curiosity around, okay, but what are the things in general that set the stage for people to have the understanding that they do? So the project ended up being an exploration where I would look for materials that already existed and sort of interweaving samples of those materials into an overall soundscape that then I set movement towards with myself on stage as a sort of juxtaposition of these two things, a real living indigenous person on stage in front of everybody, and all of these different things that have occurred that revolve around indigenous people. And what is that? What is that relationship between real indigenous people and the things that are out there that are representative of the opinions, thoughts, ideas, historical events from different perspectives? And more importantly, it sort of outlined, again, as I mentioned, that now that I know these things have played a role in the indigenous understanding, it's not as though I can just unknow them. Or to unknow them would be a grave mistake of willful ignorance.
One of the last questions I wanted to ask you for this interview was, I always am curious, like when it comes to artists, just like the role that family plays. And, you know, you spoke about growing up in an environment where you were really close to like not just family, but also like your ancestral lands, like with Nishka Nation. So I'm curious of like the role specifically, or like the influence that has generally on your practice.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that it definitely did have was an intrinsic understanding of the link between the relationships that I have, whether it's friends or family or community or culture, that those relationships are intrinsically linked to my artistic practice and to storytelling as a practice. That it's, I mean, I guess I could if I tried, but it's not as though I could like unlink those two things. And I think it gets into a really cerebral territory for me personally, because I'm sitting with this framework of like, what is our understanding and how do we come to understand that? I'm also very aware that my own lived experience plays a direct role in how I myself conceive of the idea of indigenous as a term, and that my understanding of indigeneity is directly influenced both by my own experience as an indigenous person growing up in a small town, but also because of the family in my life and of the stories that of the lives that they've led and about the relationships that they have had with their friends and their communities, that all of these things are interrelated with each other. And that also sets the stage for me to have an understanding and appreciation for the way that people in general who live near each other have the capacity to have an influence in an interrelated sense as well. It, like, my relationship to all of these things sets the stage for my understanding as it exists, I think, is the biggest part of it. And it also, I hope, though I'm not necessarily good at this thing, it also hopefully sets the stage for a level of, I don't know what I would call it, like, hopefully it sets the stage for a level of humility, grace, gratitude, and humbleness. Because I'm also very, very intimately aware of the fact that so much of what I'm sitting with as an artist is infinitely so much further beyond myself, that there's way more involved here. It certainly involves myself in so much as I'm a part of the communities that I'm a part of and that I'm hoping to impact. But my central viewpoint as a result of my relationship to community historically, and to culture, and to family, and to friends, my viewpoint that has emerged out of all of that is that, for myself, art must exist in service to the communities from which it emerges. And that sense of working in service to community through the art that I create both identifies the priority, the community, and also helps me to keep in reference what I hope is needing to be centered in conversations, in my artistic projects. And as such, a question that I try to carry at the outset of any project or opportunity is, what am I looking to center here? Who am I looking to have an impact on with a project or an opportunity like a residency? And how will I go about doing that? And I think that these things are really important because it also helps keep me away from, I don't know, unhelpful spaces of thought where I might get too caught up in, like, I don't know, this is what I think and my thoughts are this, you know, this sort of self-centered thing that you can sometimes see with a number of really, really, really successful artists. Not necessarily all the time, but like you can see some instances of that happening, of like, and even further too, it also helps keep me away from getting too caught up in what other people think about me as an artist, and keeps me away from being too, attracted to some of the pitfalls of that can come from acclaim and like, mm-hmm. Relative celebrity. Like, it keeps me humble to know that not only is this sort of my viewpoint, but it's also something that I carry as an intention, something that I'm carrying as something that I'm not just grateful to know, but something that I'm looking to enact and to carry as the center, is that so much of this is just not about me at all. And it's so much bigger than me and so much more important than just me. Not to say that I think that each person is important, but what I'm looking to do is so much bigger than whether or not, like, my name is well known. And in fact, it's something that I would much prefer, is to focus on the community, because that's the thing. It happens to manifest in art, because it's something that I'm passionate about. It's something that I resonate with. It really speaks to me that I'm also people say that I'm pretty good at it. It seems to be the case because I keep seeming to get work. So it's like, okay, I guess so. But more important than me is the community. And because that's a central component of my personal artistic mandate. Like I mentioned, art must exist in service to the communities from which it emerges. Otherwise, it becomes too self-serving for me. I think that for each person, they'll discover their own sense of an artistic mandate if they carry that specific nuance of terminology and understanding of their artistic practice. But for me, that's informed directly as a result of seeing my own lived experience and the lived experience of friends and family and community, that it's really important to be of service to the community, because that it's so central to certainly my culture, but also to the communities that I grew up around and that to the communities that I am a part of, that quite possibly the most important thing that I could pursue is anything in service to community, because the community has done so much for me, even just in a general sense of being willing to carry a level of care and space for me in ways that are not always readily available for Indigenous people. This kind of goes back to this idea of a dignified opportunity, because this is something that I heard from a colleague, Kevin Loring. He's the artistic director of Savage Society, a production company here in town for Indigenous art, as well as the artistic director of the National Arts Center's Indigenous Theater Department at the National Arts Center. He had often said that as Indigenous people, it's often the case that, or he would say that as an Indigenous artist, he often has to dislocate his shoulder to sit at the table. And that gets at this idea that, as I understand it, it gets at this idea that there may be opportunities out there for Indigenous people, but I don't know that they are so nuanced in their understanding that the question is, are they welcoming Indigenous people, or are they welcoming their idea of what Indigenous people are? And I think that also, once again, ties into the overarching question of how do we understand this Indigenous word? Because that understanding manifests itself in the social phenomena that I went on at length about earlier in this interview, but also even just in this. What does it mean to welcome Indigenous people into spaces and opportunities? And furthermore, what is their understanding of the people who are looking to set the stage for opportunities in the first place? And how does that influence the experience of the people taking up those opportunities and taking up that space? And has the stage been set for people to feel fully welcome? And those types of things are directly informed as well by my sense of knowing what it really does feel like to be welcomed into a space as a community member, and to understand that that is a much more dignified, fully representative iteration of that. Because to be welcomed into an Indigenous community, there's sort of an intrinsic understanding that goes along with that to some degree, because they're also Indigenous. So it's like there's some things that don't really need to be said or unpacked, because it just goes along with it in many instances. Whereas outside of those spaces, it can be very easy to identify through what's missing that there are things that are missing, or that there are things that are not actively embodied in opportunities, or in even just in... Because I talked about this idea of the mainstream catching on more and more to the truth and reconciliation conversation, and to the Indigenous conversation, and to the relationship and history of this country towards Indigenous people and with Indigenous people and against Indigenous people, that even just approaching the conversation, I think a further question that emerges is, are people looking to actually engage with Indigenous people, or are they looking to engage with what their idea of what Indigenous people are. Okay. What set the stage for them to have that understanding in the first place? And then we sort of tie back into the, which is what makes it so enormous in the first place. Like, it's a word, Indigenous. We can sort of identify some key meanings of it as a term that gets used in conversation. We could talk about First Nations, Métis, Inuit, and those are very important things. But even just in, like, before we get into this sort of cerebral metaphysical territory that I'm outlining, even before we get there, the term is already enormous. And it also has historical indicators that are not just tied to this country, but to Turtle Island and to a global sense of indigeneity. But it's so massive as a term that as an artist, I feel compelled to be like, well, okay, hold on. I know, yes, absolutely, truth and reconciliation. But before we even set out on that journey, what are we thinking? What set the stage for how we're approaching the conversation in the first place? Because that information is also important to understanding the broader colonial mechanism, the colonial entity. A part of the way that social systems like colonialism manifest is in the way that people occupy positions within the system. And the way that people occupy positions within the system is what informs, in part, how they understand the terms that are used to articulate what the system is. Even if what they can articulate is just, here's what I think I know, and here's how I arrived at that. Those are such massive pieces of information in the process of identifying the colonial entity that can then really be beneficial to our approach to a genuine, dignified truth and reconciliation. It's an integral component, in my view, of the truth of colonialism and of the reconciliation process that is dependent on our understanding of the truth. And this gets us into a conversation about the foundational nature of what we're trying to do supposedly as a country and as people. If a person is interested or feels compelled who is not Indigenous to be an ally, I think these are also very important questions to sit with, because it can set the stage for an even richer, even more dignified approach, even just as an ally, but on a broad level. Can we both unpack but also give nuance to the way that we understand these things so that in the multiple ways that going forward, these understandings set the stage for different things to manifest like opportunities so that Indigenous people don't feel continually like we have to dislocate our shoulders anytime we're invited into an opportunity? And then what sets the stage for that? And
specifically, when you, like, one of the things you mentioned is, like, yeah, for people who are even considered themselves to be, like, allies or in support of self-determination and things of that nature, it's still important to reckon with and to really, like, identify, like, what do I define indigeneity to mean? What are the terms that I use to define it? And, like, what does that represent?
Mm-hmm. And the thing about those questions that I definitely think that's really crucial. Another part of what I carry as an artist and as something that I hope to offer to other people is this idea that I've been sitting with of questions as process. There are some questions that we can answer with more or less affirmativeness, I guess. Like, what's the weather? It's like, oh, it's really sunny out. Now, I guess we could get into, like, a really cerebral debate if we're talking, like, physics or whatever about, like, okay, but what does sunny actually mean? But we could say, oh, that's the weather. There's an answer to that question. But there's some questions, like, what does the word Indigenous mean to me? What comes to my mind when I say the word Indigenous? What comes to your mind when I say the word Indigenous? Those are questions that I almost think they're almost like objects, like things that you can carry, like something that you can pick up or that can be given to you or that you can discover. And as I go about on this journey in my life, as everyone must, it's just the nature of life. Time keeps moving. And as a person, I probably have things to do. I've got groceries to run and do. I've got this phone call I've got to make or whatever it is. I gotta show up to work. I can carry and hold that question with me and continually return to it to see what it helps me unpack or what it helps me discover or how it shifts my understanding or even my relationship to the question itself. I can carry it like a thing with me in my journey through life. And I won't necessarily come to the answer with a capital A, but I can continually be in process with the question itself as something that is a component of my unfolding journey in life. So that as I go about and I'm talking to this person over there and I see this thing over here and this event happens here and this is that part of my life or whatever, I can sort of, every so often, something that might catch my attention, I can sort of return to the question and how it relates to my journey and my understanding and how all of these things are interwoven with each other. And then I could just keep moving again. These are that type of question, as opposed to, because I certainly have my own opinions about social events and about indigenous current events and history and decolonialism and all of this other stuff and truth and reconciliation. I've got opinions that will present themselves as answers, and this is what I think. But the questions underneath those things are really what's important on a broader level, because those set the stage for other people to be in their own journey, in their relationship to their understanding of knowledge, more important than what I particularly think. Because the other side of this coin is that, of course, any indigenous person will have their own opinion of it as well as any person in general. So it's like, okay, I've got all these understandings and ideas and all of this other stuff, but I'm just a person and I'm working just in service to the community. And in that way, but in so many other ways, that's one iteration of why it's so much bigger than me and so much bigger than what I think is the question, because the question is the process that I hope to imbue on a larger scale as a way to say yes and. That idea of, like, what does indigenous mean to me is something that I don't think there's a clear answer to, because it's a process. And that's what I hope to really give to other people as an artist.
Once again, that was our interview with C. Peel, the Indigenous Storyteller in Residence at the Vancouver Public Library. This has been Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming up next, we have Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, right at 11 a.m., so you don't want to go anywhere. And we have a lot of other amazing programming coming your way today at noon. We have Raccoon City, typically Tuesdays later in the afternoon. And later tonight, we have Slumber Party and Bitcoover at 8 p.m. A lot of amazing live programming coming your way today. You don't want to miss it. Thank you once again for tuning in. And to end off the hour, let's play a little bit of local music. This is the band Whack with One More Tizime.